From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, is it time to reform our election system? We talk with Robert Pastor. He established the election monitoring system for the Carter Center and has observed elections around the world. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz joins us to talk about the other part of his writing life, poetry. And he reads from his new collection, Cairo Traffic. And Maureen Corrigan has a review of posthumously published books by Jack Kerouac and Iris Murdoch. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Florida's Supreme Court heard arguments today on whether hand-recounted votes should be included in the state's final presidential vote tally. In a proceeding that was broadcast on national television, the justices questioned lawyers for the various parties on how much time Florida has to certify a winner, and still have its representatives take part in the Electoral College vote. Democrats said the state has until December 12th, 6 days before the Electoral College meets. A lawyer for Florida's Secretary of State argued that state law requires her to certify a winner by 7 days after the election. Other issues discussed today include the standards used in the current recounts and the possibility of conducting a statewide recount. The justices didn't indicate when they'll announce their decision. A judge in Palm Beach County has ruled against ordering a new election sought by county residents who say they were confused by the presidential ballot. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from West Palm Beach.
Circuit Judge George Labarga wrote that it's not legally possible to hold a new election in the county because the U.S. Constitution clearly requires presidential elections be held on the same day throughout the country, and that electors be elected on the same day nationally as well. Charles Chester, an attorney for some of the citizens who filed suit, said his clients would appeal.
People were not only confused with the ballot, but when they double voted, a number of election officials in a number of precincts refused to give them substitute ballots. That's a problem. And in a close election, it matters.
Meanwhile, the hand recount continues here in Palm Beach County. So far, with about 20% of the precincts counted, there's been very little change in the vote tallies. Democrats are upset that some 200 ballots with Gore votes have been discounted because they weren't punched through fully. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, West Palm Beach.
War crimes prosecutors made their closing arguments today in the Foča case. Three Serbian defendants are accused of using systematic rape as a tool for ethnic cleansing. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from The Hague.
Asking for sentences ranging up to 35 years in prison, a prosecutor noted it might be said no sentence this court could possibly devise could adequately deal with what was done to women in Foča. This trial's come to be called the rape case because it's focused on the deliberate enslavement, torture, rape, and degradation of women. 8 months of often unbearable testimony by women, many of whom had never told their stories before, established a pattern not just of rape, but of gratuitously sadistic rape. One woman saying she was raped by 15 soldiers in a single evening. One defendant, identified by 10 of the witnesses as personally having raped them, often a number of times over the course of 4 months, and encouraging soldiers under his command to do likewise. His defense was that one of his victims, a 16-year-old girl, raped him. Sarah Chase, NPR News, The Hague.
This is NPR. A top U.S. diplomat visited southern Sudan today to draw attention to the practice of slavery in the African nation. Susan Rice, the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, said the U.S. will work to stamp out slavery in Sudan, which is split by a long-running civil war. The Sudanese government and some members of the European Union deny that slavery is still practiced in Sudan. Rice visited with women who said they were recently freed slaves, and she said that part of her visit is designed to show that slavery exists. Former tennis star John McEnroe has resigned as captain of the Davis Cup tennis team. McEnroe was appointed captain just over a year ago, but it was a year filled with frustration. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
In his prime, John McEnroe was the poster boy for bad behavior on a tennis court, but even his critics couldn't deny his unabashed patriotism when it came to Davis Cup, a team event in which players compete for their country. As a player, McEnroe led the United States on its last run of Davis Cup dominance in the late 1970s and early 80s. After 14 difficult months as team captain, however, neither his love of the event nor his fiery personality could return the country to prominence. He struggled to get the best players, Pete Sampras and Andre Agassi, to compete. He also was frustrated with the year-round Davis Cup schedule, saying it made it hard to consistently put together a winning team. In July, without Sampras and Agassi, the U.S. lost to Spain 5-0 in the semifinals, leaving McEnroe, in his words, deflated. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 167 points, or 1.4%, to close at 10,462. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of all-natural vitamin E, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The confusion, accusations, suits, and countersuits surrounding the Florida recount has a lot of Americans wondering if it's time to reform the election system. My guest, Robert Pastor, has witnessed elections around the world. He established the election monitoring system for the Carter Center and for 13 years worked with monitoring teams in Latin America, the Caribbean, the Middle East, and China. During the Carter administration, he served on the National Security Council. Pastor is a professor of political science at Emory University in Atlanta. I spoke with him early this morning. How worried are you by what you're seeing? You've seen people try to steal elections around the world, and you've tried to prevent that from happening. Do you think that we're in a crisis point in how this recount is being handled in the United States? Are you concerned that part of our democracy is breaking down?
I'm not concerned at all. In fact, I think in some ways this is the finest moment for America. We have discovered that in a very close election, we have a system of procedures. We have people who are actively engaged, who are volunteering their work, who are working very hard to make sure this process comes to completion. We have an independent judiciary, which we all respect. So I'm not concerned about it for the United States. I think in other countries that I've observed, this is a moment in which riots often break out. I was in one country in which the Election Commission was almost burned down during the count. I don't think we have any reason to be concerned about that in the United States. I think this should be an opportunity not only to be patient and watch the process work, but I also hope that it's an opportunity for Americans to think hard about ways that we can improve this system so that we can avoid these particular problems, as well as other problems that have emerged during this very long and expensive campaign. And we can think hard about what kinds of reforms we need to prevent these kinds of problems from occurring again.
You have seen warring parties be very suspicious of each other in foreign countries where you've monitored elections. How do you think the Democrats and the Republicans have been handling themselves in this really close election as they watch each other during the recount in Florida, as they watch each other during all the suits and the countersuits?
Elections are a process by which competing parties and candidates struggle for power. And once you keep that in mind, you understand why the heat between the parties is likely to be very intense during every phase of the process, particularly during the counting phase. So I'm not at all surprised by the partisanship between the two leading parties. One would expect that. The critical question is whether you can insulate that partisanship from the counting process and the judicial process. And I believe that our system permits that and does have certain walls that will separate the partisan debate from the actual resolution of these particular disputes.
One of the questions about partisanship revolves around Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State in Florida, who co-chaired George W. Bush's election campaign in that state. Is it typical in states, do you think, for somebody who is clearly that partisan to be in a Secretary of State type of position where you're supervising part of the election and deciding when the count is ready to be certified?
It is typical that secretaries of state in most states are aspiring politicians. It's unfortunate, however, that particular job and the kind of people that are encouraged to run for that office is viewed as partisan. I believe this is still one more of the problems that we ought to resolve in the future. The person in each state who should be charged with the conduct of elections should be a person that's seen above as above politics, not as an aspiring politician.
How do you think they should be chosen? I mean, people in politics tend to choose people who share their political point of view.
I think we ought to reevaluate the way we look at the electoral process. We've taken the entire process for granted for far too long. But now we understand that the conduct of elections is at least as important as the regulation of our money or the resolution of disputes. And therefore, we should think about choosing our senior election officials much as we choose our judges or we choose the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank. These individuals are seen as above politics, and they're above politics in part because of the process by which they're selected, which is usually that they're nominated by one side or the other, but they need to be approved and confirmed by both parties. And the only way that occurs is if everybody sees them as above politics. Secondly, their term of office should exceed that of the political mandate. In the states, for example, they should exceed the term of the governor so that their time horizon is much broader, and they think of the broader state and national interest as opposed to the interest of the party in power.
Let's look at the butterfly ballot, the controversial ballot that was used in Palm Beach County, in which some of the names were to some of the punches were to the left of the name and others were to the right of the name in the opposing column. And a lot of people say that they meant to vote for Gore Lieberman and inadvertently, because the ballot was confusing, voted for Patrick Buchanan. Any opinion of the design, having worked with elections and ballots around the world?
The design makes a big difference. I have to say that I don't recall an instance in which a national election was designed by a local official. I think this is a case of where our system is so excessively decentralized that a particular county can make such a decision, and that decision could affect the entire country. It would seem to me that at the minimum, a national commission should design the ballot for the presidency. Obviously, the ballots for local and state officials need to be designed at different levels, but at least at the national level, there should be one single design.
You've said that the absentee ballot system is the part of the electoral system that has the biggest problems with fraud. Why is that so?
That's because I think the political parties can play a major role in both getting the absentee ballots and having voters vote for them. There are cases, of course, in which the parties themselves or certain individuals were able to fill out the absentee ballots themselves. And, of course, that is blatant fraud. The biggest problem, of course, is that the essence of a free election is a secure and secret vote. And that's not possible with an absentee ballot. Or to put it differently, I think an absentee ballot is not quite so secure. A person might very well vote in the presence of others. Somebody might vote for that person. So there are many different areas in which the absentee ballot could be misused. And in part because of the history of absentee ballot fraud in Florida, the Florida State Legislature within the last few years have passed a law which sets a large number of requirements that must be met before the ballot could be considered valid. And many of these requirements, such as witnessing of the vote by a separate individual, the use of the voter registration number, the specific signature must match the signature that's on hand at the registration office. There are a whole set of regulations which, if they are not precisely implemented, would lead to the declaration of the ballot as being invalid. And so you have two different sets of problems. One is the traditional use of the absentee ballot in the case of possible use of fraud, and the other is whether it stands up to all of the additional requirements that are have been put in place.
If you were given the job of reforming the American election system, where would you start?
Well, there are many different places in which the American electoral system needs to be reformed. From the nature of the machines that we use, to the design of the ballot, to the excessive decentralization in which individual counties can make decisions that affect a people's right to vote for a president. There is partisanship at different moments in the electoral process where there should not be. Our campaigns go on for far too long. They're far too expensive, making it too open for special interests to control the process. Our Federal Election Commission does not function very effectively. Our Electoral College right now is an obsolete, archaic system in which people do not have the opportunity to directly elect their president. There are so many different things that need to be corrected that one hopes that this latest case of what's going on in Florida will move our country and move all the people in our country to demand some significant reforms in the electoral process to permit greater democracy to function as our founding fathers and intended it to function in our country.
Do you think this election makes the case against the Electoral College?
Well, I believe that the case against the Electoral College has been made many times in the past, very effectively, too. I think the basic argument in the against the Electoral College is a very simple one, and that is that if you believe that in one person, every person should have an equal vote in the president, and that that vote should translate and be aggregated to decide on the president, then you don't want to have an indirect system in which electors can make up their own mind independently of the people's vote, and that that outcome could be different from the popular vote. I mean, that's the argument in favor of reforming the Electoral College. Of course, our Constitution makes it very difficult for us to reform that particular provision of the Constitution because small states might feel that they will have less power in the decision of the president, and therefore they're unlikely to approve of such a reform.
My guest is Robert Pastor. He established the election monitoring system for the Carter Center and has monitored elections around the world. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Pastor is my guest. He's a professor of political science at Emory University, and he established the election monitoring system for the Carter Center and worked with the Carter Center for 13 years. What are some of the lessons about elections that you've learned from supervising elections in other countries?
Well, the first and most important lesson is that for an election to work, the administrators must be seen as nonpartisan and impartial. Secondly, the process needs to be completely transparent, which is another way of saying that all of the key political parties should have an opportunity to observe the full range of electoral processes, especially during the count. If you have impartial administration and you have a transparent election in which the observers of the parties can watch everything, I think this these are two very critical ingredients. The third one is an independent judiciary or an electoral court. A lot of countries have not only independent election commissions, national election commissions, they also have national electoral courts. These are judges with great wisdom, nonpartisanship, and professionalism in the judging of electoral law. Again, we don't have anything like that in the United States, but this might be one reform that we might want to consider in the future.
Is there an election system that you helped create in another country that you're particularly proud of that you think functions really well?
No, I have not created election system in any other country. I don't know of any foreigner that has. But there are a wide range of election systems that have been created by their own people that should gain our attention during this critical moment. We only have to look towards our neighbor, Elections Canada. They are conducting an election right now, in which the campaign has been condensed to just 36 days, not 4 years, in which the amount of money that's contributed to the parties is somewhere between $15 and $50 million, as opposed to $3 billion, as we've just seen in the presidential cycle. We can look to Costa Rica that has an independent electoral court, which is widely admired by all of the candidates and parties and by most of Latin America as well. And also, its election commission is viewed as a fourth branch of government, equal to the other three branches, the judicial, the legislative, and the executive branches of government. So there's much that we can learn from other countries in the world.
You've brought people from other parts of the world to the United States to see how elections here operate. What are some of the things that the people you've brought here have admired and have been really kind of surprised at and disappointed in?
In 1992, we brought a group of Mexican officials representing the political parties to the United States. Our ulterior purpose was to encourage the Mexican government to invite foreigners to look at their election in 1994, and in fact, that did work. But the more interesting thing that came out of their observation was that they were very surprised that there were so few party monitors, that the regulations were actually so thin, that the process was so open that at one point one of them said, this would be a very easy system to manipulate. And I asked him, well, why do you think most Americans have confidence in the electoral process here and so few Mexicans have? And that began a very interesting discussion in which we all concluded at the end that it was because electoral disputes and problems which emerge in both sets of countries were perceived to be resolved fairly in the United States. And that was not the case in Mexico at that time. They did not have, at that time, an independent election commission. They did not have an independent judiciary. They now have an independent election commission. They still have problems with their judiciary. So the comparison, both for the Mexicans and the Americans, was very interesting. And I think we came to appreciate both the differences and the special advantages that accrue as a result of an independent judiciary in the United States.
Tell the story of what happened when you took Chinese election officials to Atlanta to watch you vote.
Yes. Actually, in two of the last four elections in which observers have been watching me vote, I've run into particular problems. In the time with the Chinese, there was a runoff of a primary. They were just arriving at that particular time. And the election officials wouldn't permit me to vote for that runoff because they said that I had voted for the other party's primary. That was not the case. And I protested. And in order for there to be both an opportunity for me to vote, but also a learning experience for our Chinese visitors. And sure enough, the polling officials handled it very well. They made a phone call to Fulton County Courthouse and were able to ascertain exactly for which party I had voted in the original primary, established that they had made a mistake, and therefore permitted me to vote. So the lesson for the Chinese was every election in every country often has irregularities and problems. The critical issue is whether there is a process for resolving those problems expeditiously and fairly so that people can, in fact, exercise their right to vote.
And what happened more recently?
In this last election, I went and I was told that I had already received an absentee ballot and therefore would not be permitted to vote. I said, well, that was not the case. My son, who has a similar name, had received an absentee ballot, but I had not. The registration list indicated clearly, however, that I had received one. I protested, and the chief election official came over to me with an affidavit asking me to sign it, that in which he co-signed, which indicated clearly that if this represented a second vote on my part, that would be a felony, a crime, since I was confident that I had not voted as an absentee. That was certainly satisfactory to me, and it permitted me to vote. Once again, this was a good example. I brought my students to this election, a good example of that problems do emerge, and we, in fact, witness a great deal of irregularities on election day. The critical issue, once again, is whether or not there's a process for resolving this problem expeditiously and permitting a person to exercise their franchise. And in this case, it occurred.
But, you know, you're a special person. You not only know your way around the election system, you have people with you, you know, from other countries observing American elections. So you're going to be taken care of in a very punctual way. Other people might not have it so easy when a mistake is made.
You're absolutely correct. In the course of our election observation, we asked some waitresses at a diner which we stopped to eat whether they'd had a chance to vote. These were poor African-American women, and they said that they had tried, but they were not able to. And we asked what had happened, and they said they went to their polling site, and they showed us their election credential, which was very good. And they said their name was not on the list, and they were told to call a phone number, which they called all day long, but it was busy. And as a result, they were not able to vote, and a lot of their friends were not able to vote. But they also did not know how to work the process, as I did. So you're absolutely correct. I think this is one of these big problems. There are a lot of people out there. Usually they're poor, and they therefore don't know how to pursue their interests, or they're in poor communities, and it's very difficult to do so, that may have not been enfranchised, but should have been. They have a very low level of administrative development and a lower capacity to problem solve, that is to say, poorer communities do. And when that occurs, people are disenfranchised, and we need to correct that problem. My guess is that it occurs throughout the United States. And this is one of many different issues which we really need to take a close look at.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Robert Pastor established the election monitoring system for the Carter Center. He's a professor of political science at Emory University. Our interview was recorded this morning. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks with us about the other side of his writing life, poetry, and he reads from his new collection, Cairo Traffic. And Maureen Corrigan reviews posthumously published books by Jack Kerouac and Iris Murdoch. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our classical music critic, Lord Schwartz, won a Pulitzer Prize in 1994 for his music criticism. Music criticism is just one part of his writing life. Lord's third book of poetry has just been published. It's called Cairo Traffic. Lord also directs the creative writing program at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, and co-edited the book Elizabeth Bishop and Her Art. We invited him for a reading and conversation. Let's start with the poem that opens his new book. It's called A True Poem.
A true poem. I'm working on a poem that's so true, I can't show it to anyone. I could never show it to anyone, because it says exactly what I think, and what I think scares me. Sometimes it pleases me. Usually it brings misery. And this poem says exactly what I think. What I think of myself, what I think of my friends, what I think about my lover. Exactly. Parts of it might please them. Some of it might scare them. Some of it might bring misery. And I don't want to hurt them. I don't want to hurt them. I don't want to hurt anybody. I want everyone to love me. Still, I keep working on it. Why? Why do I keep working on it? Nobody will ever see it. Nobody will ever see it. I keep working on it even though I can never show it to anybody. I keep working on it even though someone might get hurt.
That's Lord Schwartz reading from his new collection of poems, Cairo Traffic. So, Lloyd, do you have such a poem that's too honest for anyone to read?
I wish I did. I was actually working on something that I couldn't show anyone. I didn't think I could show anyone. And I was stumped by it also, and I think that the channel got switched to actually thinking about writing that poem, and that's where this poem came from.
You know, your poem, A True Poem, which you read, is about some of the problems that one faces when they write about their honest perceptions of other people. You've written a series of poems about your mother, and in these poems, it isn't an issue what your mother will think, because your mother has Alzheimer's disease and is beyond kind of comprehending the poems or even recognizing you as her son. How did you start writing poems about her and her condition?
I almost have no control over the subject matter of my own poems. And if I'm feeling something deeply enough, I may not even want to write about it, as was the case with my mother's, with the beginning stages of my mother's illness. And then I couldn't think about anything else, and the subject just took hold, and I had to write about it, everything else had to be shoved aside. And I was also so moved by the things that she said. And my mother was never a writer. I wish she had been. I think in some way the extraordinary things that she was saying to me, I wanted to commemorate. I wanted to capture her mind and her thoughts and her words, which she herself would never have written down. And that just took over, became a passion.
Let me ask you to read a few lines of your poem, The Dream During My Mother's Recuperation. And this is a collection of, at least I assume it's a collection of some of the things that she said with memory loss.
Yes, it is. Starting when she was in the hospital for a very serious operation, and her recovery from that operation, I feel lost.
I'm heading for nowhere. I have to stop somewhere to see where I'm landing. Whatever is going on will be going on without me. It passes so fast. That's life. The winter sun is like a stepmother's love.
Did you actually take notes when she was speaking to you?
I actually did. I was visiting her in the hospital. She was not expected to recover from this surgery that she went through. And she was saying the most remarkable things. And at some point, I started writing down the things that she was saying. I just wanted to remember them. My original intention was not, oh, I got to turn this into a poem, but that I just wanted to remember some of these things that she was saying. And then really at some later point, I thought, you know, this is a poem. She is giving me a poem.
I want to ask you to read one of your poems about your mother, and this is called She Forgets. Tell us when you wrote this and what stage of her illness she was in.
She Forgets was in the earlier stages of her memory loss. She had been hospitalized, and she was not permitted to leave the hospital for home. She had to be put into a nursing home. And she was put into a nursing home that was really not the right place for her to be. And it took months and months to get her into a better facility. And this is really a poem about her that first experience in a nursing home and her pain and helplessness about her, both her physical and her mental situation. She forgets. The one who told me about the Holocaust, who taught me moral distinctions, who gave me music and told me jokes, is in a nursing home, lonely, scared, surrounded only by people so much worse off, inarticulate, incapacitated, drooling. She thinks she's in a crazy house. She's not crazy. She's there. I put her there because she can't take care of herself, can't be left alone. She's old. She forgets. She forgets her medicine. She forgets what she's not supposed to eat. She forgets what day it is. She remembers who she is and who she was and knows she's not herself. She can't remember what's wrong with her. What's wrong with me, honey? Or why she's there. But she knows her brain isn't working right. Her brain needs air. Oxygen has a hard time squeezing through her hardened arteries, so her blood congeals. Little clots cause little strokes, which destroy her memory. Aspirin, which thins the blood and helps keep the oxygen flowing, might help her remember. But she's old. Part of her stomach has turned upside down. Her food gets stuck in her chest, blocks her breath. She panics, forces herself to vomit, which makes her bleed, which damages her heart. A simple operation could fix her stomach, but doctors won't operate on someone with a damaged heart. And aspirin makes her bleed, so she can't take aspirin, so she forgets. I live in another city. Once after I came to visit, she wasn't thinking about her food. She ate too much or too fast, and the food wouldn't go down. So she panicked, forced herself to vomit, and had a heart attack. She was in the hospital for 3 weeks, which she doesn't remember. So I've had to put the one who gave me music and told me jokes, who taught me moral distinctions and warned me never to forget the Holocaust. I've had to put her in a nursing home, a crazy house, where she's scared and lonely, where she stares out the window and asks, "What day is today? Why can't I go home? What's wrong with me, honey? Why am I here?"
Lloyd, that poem was written several years ago, and I think you must look back on that period as when she was comparatively healthy.
Yes. Yes. Now she doesn't know who she is anymore, and she doesn't know who I am anymore. It was hard to think of anything worse at the time that what was happening, that's in She Forgets, was happening, and but it's worse.
How is she now?
She's very weak, very tired, extremely confused. That's how she is.
Do you still remember what your mother was like before she was sick, or has she been sick for so long that that's the main image you have of her?
Oh, no. I remember very vividly what she was like. I mean, in many ways, she was, she certainly remained one of the closest people in my life. Much closer to me than my father was. There was kind of war between me and my father, which she mediated. But very much. I mean, she was someone I would go to movies with when I was a child, or go to plays, and she was the person who told me most of the jokes that I knew, and I would even tell her some of the jokes that I'd heard. Sometimes not very polite ones, but she seemed to get a kick out of them. And she did love music. She was very involved in she loved popular music and Broadway shows. And she went when she was a younger woman, and she would tell me about those experiences. So I remember her very well. She was very much the center of my extended family.
My guest is our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, who's also a poet. His new collection of poems is called Cairo Traffic. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Lloyd Schwartz. You probably recognize him as Fresh Air's classical music critic. Lloyd is also a poet and has a new collection called Cairo Traffic. Your new collection of poems, Cairo Traffic, is named after the final poem in the book. And the final poem is really, in a way, a collection of poems and short prose pieces about your trip to Egypt. And the poem is really, in part, about art and religion, death and the desire for immortality, a lot of the things that seeing what you saw in Egypt got you thinking about. I'm going to ask you to read the end of Cairo Traffic.
Okay. No, I haven't converted, though in fact I find I have a lot of sympathy with elements of what I understand to be the religion of ancient Egypt, life and death. Order and chaos seem to have been worshipped equally. And I, who believe there's reason for everything, that everything makes sense if one tries hard enough, I believe with equal conviction that reason is an illusion, that nothing ever makes sense. I'm afraid I'll lose the past, so I don't throw anything away. so I live in chaos. A visitor once asked if I was planning to take everything with me to the next world. My real conversion took place when I was 13. I lost confidence in religion. I still believed in morality. Later, I believed in art. In Israel, at the Western Wall, I found a surprising residue of feeling for everything I'd been taught to worship as a child. But in Egypt, something else. Something about the relation between how massive these monuments are, how heroic, and how old, older than almost anything else we call art, and fragile. They've been on Earth so long, they seem tired of it, tired of time.
Thanks for reading that, Lloyd, and that's from the title poem, Cairo Traffic, from Lloyd's new book. Tell me more about how, you know, visiting the Middle East, which is a land we, you know, lands that we identify with ancient religions. Did it make you rethink religion at all, or was it more about art for you?
Well, it certainly, I mean, it was very much about art, but it also was a very powerful image, both, as I say, even in Israel at the Wailing Wall, to actually be there triggered these kind of, these sort of recessed memories from my childhood, and I really did feel here was a kind of manifestation, a kind of heroic physical manifestation. Of the power of religion, and it was an extraordinary experience, and it did make me go back to it. Certainly tapped feelings that I hadn't really had in many decades.
Do you think of yourself as a prolific poet?
Oh no, just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean. This very narrow little book is 10 years of work, and I've published a book every decade. So these books contain almost every poem that I've written in the in that 10-year period.
When you're not writing a poem, do you think that you're still a poet, or do you think you're someone who used to be a poet?
Sometimes I think I'm still a poet. I certainly hope I'm still a poet. I'm afraid I used to be a poet. There's a kind of network of anxieties and satisfactions and fears that are kind of inextricable.
How do you know when you want to write a poem about something? I mean, do you ever try to force it and figure it's not happening, or is it pretty clear when a perception or an experience is leading to a poem?
I'm not a great role model for my students because I tell my students that they need to work at it and they need to keep writing all the time. And, of course, I am writing all the time. I'm writing music reviews all the time. But I tend to resist writing poems. I mean, I want to write poems, but usually when something comes to me that, that makes me want to write, my first response is, I'd love to write a poem, but I'm way too busy. I just have much too much to do to stop everything and write a poem. And then I have to write it, and everything else has to be put aside. So that doesn't happen with extraordinary frequency, but when it happens, it is overwhelming, and there's nothing else I could do. I have no choice, and I don't sleep much, and there are always deadlines that I have to meet, but the poem has to get written.
Well, Lloyd, thank you so much for reading some of your poems to us. A pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Terry. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, too.
Lloyd Schwartz is our classical music critic. His new collection of poems is called Cairo Traffic. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews posthumously published books by Jack Kerouac and Iris Murdoch. This is Fresh Air. Perishing doesn't necessarily put an end to publishing, as two new books by Jack Kerouac and Iris Murdoch demonstrate. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
As a breed, writers are pack rats, and so when they die, they usually leave behind lots of paper, manuscripts, letters, diaries, juvenilia. Sometimes their surviving relatives house clean to the detriment of posterity, like Jane Austen's sister Cassandra, who destroyed most of her letters. These days, however, famous writers' heirs often succumb to the lure of easy money and allow lots of literary junk to be published that should have been tossed into the paper recycling bin. There was that dreadful Lost novel by Hemingway that resurfaced two summers ago, the recently published embarrassing love letters of J.D. Salinger to Joyce Maynard. I know, Salinger isn't dead yet. He just acts like he is. And with almost annual regularity, volumes of letters, doodlings, and drafts by the beat angel Jack Kerouac. The latest Kerouac book from the beyond is a novella called Orpheus Emerged that Kerouac wrote in 1945 when he was 23. It's pretty bad, but in an over-the-top, morbidly interesting kind of way. The story concerns a pilgrim soul named Paul who immerses himself in Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, and cheap wine. Paul falls in with a pre-hipster student crowd around an unnamed university. The young men are all gloomy. They write poetry, argue about hypnoanalysis, and harbor unspoken homoerotic feelings for each other. The young women, referred to as the mistresses, wear tight pants and cook up plates of food that they place like silent offerings on the men's writing desks. Kerouac supposedly wrote Orpheus Emerged soon after meeting Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, and the rest of that infamous Columbia gang, so the novella has some Romana Clef appeal. The tortured arguments about art that compose much of its dialogue are also rather charming. Granted, not so charming that I want to read page after page of characters saying things like, "Pain is the law of the artist's life." But Orpheus Emerged did remind me of the earnestness of the Beats, and in this age of irony, I feel sentimental about their aesthetic sincerity. Probably the most intriguing aspect of Orpheus Emerged is the way it's being published, as an e-book, tricked out with interactive hypertexts, audio and video accompaniments, an introduction by Robert Creeley, and still more never-before-published shreds of Kerouac's journals. Fans of e-publishing argue that it's more democratic because manuscripts don't have to be vetted by gatekeepers of literary culture like agents and editors. Skeptics like me suspect that most e-books will read more like spam mail than literature. Gatekeepers may not be perfect, but they do help stave off the avalanche of words, words, empty words. Orpheus Emerged will probably slink back into the darkness after its debut, so it's fitting that it's being published in a comparatively ephemeral form. Not so Iris Murdoch's recently rediscovered short story, Something Special. its mode of publication virtually shouts out, "This is great art." Something Special, a title which Murdoch surely intended to be ironic and which her publishers seem to have taken straight, is being printed in hardback on fine paper, complete with woodcut illustrations. All this for a short story that was published only once before in the 1950s, in Japanese. A lot of people, myself included, felt simultaneously queasy and grateful that Murdoch's husband, John Bailey, wrote that moving and humiliating memoir of her descent into Alzheimer's disease called Elegy for Iris. I'm doubly grateful that Bailey violated Murdoch's privacy after reading Something Special, which probably wouldn't have been published like this were it not for the renewed attention that the memoir drew to Murdoch. Something Special is a devastating short story about limited options and the pitfalls of romanticism. It takes place during one night in Dublin in the 1950s. A 24-year-old spinster named Yvonne is being pressured by her mother and uncle to marry her suitor, a moon-faced Jewish tailor named Sam. At first, Yvonne evokes sympathy. She's a dreamy bookworm who protests her mother's interference by saying, "Can't I live my life as I please, since it's the only thing I have?" But as Yvonne and Sam proceed with their evening date, she's obviously so hard to please and whingy that sympathy dries up. And then it floods back during the very last page of this dark and emotionally complex story. Literary grave robbing is largely an unsavory and unrewarding job. But every once in a while, the shovels strike a part of a corpus that's still kicking.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Something Special by Iris Murdoch and Orpheus Emerged by Jack Kerouac. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of The Change Before the Change, Everything You Need to Know to Stay Healthy in the Decade Before Menopause, by Dr. Laura E. Corio and Linda G. Kahn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, film editor Dee Dee Allen. She edited such films as The Hustler, Bonnie and Clyde, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, and The Wonder Boys, which has just been re-released. Also, we meet clarinetist and composer Andy Biskin, whose CD we're listening to now. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.